You are now listening to the Someone's Favorite Productions podcast network.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the New World Pictures podcast and welcome to Corman Graduates, a series where we examine the filmography of some of the graduates of Corman's School of Filmmaking. I'm Ryan. With me always is Mark.
I'm still here.
And Erica.
Hey. Oh, I just got here. Hey. Oh, Mark. Hey, Mark.
Oh, hey, Erica. Oh, my
good
gosh.
Good to see you.
Oh, are good you still, to see you, too.
Are you still doing this podcast thing?
I'm still doing it. It's been, I didn't think that we'd still be doing it. Are you still doing it?
Or good is this for just you, man. Yeah, I'm still, still showing up. Why not?
Wow, that's awesome.
Until they kick me out, you know? Good
that's
to see
awesome.
You, man. Good to see you.
Good to see you, too. Wow. And hi, Ryan.
Hey, Ryan.
Oh, yeah, hi, guys. And we are on to episode 5 of Jack Hill. And who better to be our guest for this episode? The man behind MondoDigital.com, the author of the Fright Fest Guide to Vampire Movies, Nathaniel Thompson, is joining us for the show.
Thank you so much for joining.
Thank you for having me. It's going to be tons and tons of fun. I love me some Jack Hill.
Good. Nice. I wanted to ask you about your history with him, but first, like Mondo Digital, you have been around, and I have been reading your reviews for years. But you've been around since like the 90s.
There's not many. Yeah, March of 98.
What did you build the site on to begin with? At that point in time,
it was like really that was back when Laserdiscs were still around. Laserdiscs and DVDs were just getting started, and I noticed that there were like a lot of movie review sites were just starting to get off the ground. You had general ones like DVD review and things like that. And there were like a few little horror sites, but nobody really did the wider scope, like just the cult movies, the art movies. Cause to me, there's so much overlap. And I was like, just pretty much all the strange stuff that's around the mainstream, you know, it all kind of blends together. And that's what I wanted to do. And it's still kind of the only site that really takes that approach, I think, as far as I know, but yeah, I'm still hanging in there and I love it.
And there's probably a few eras in there. Like, I mean, I don't think right now, I think we're in like an incredible era for physical media, but there's been some lean times.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, you think about the early DVD days, which is where Jack Hill kind of really exploded in popularity when Anchor Bay did the first round, you know, that was kind of like the Wild West period where nobody really knew what this business was and anybody was starting their own label and it was fun. And then we kind of had a dip for a long time and then streaming killed stuff for a while. And now discs are cool again. So it comes and goes, but yeah, it'll never die. I hope.
Yeah. I hope so too. But yeah. And it feels like right now there's so many companies and you know,
there's more physical media stuff coming out there before. I've never had my mailbox get like pummeled the way it does now. I mean, so dying format, you could have fooled me. I don't see it.
Also your book, tell us about your book, Fright Fest Guide to Vampire Movies. Was that?
Yes. So, so every year Fright Fest in England, it's one of the biggest horror festivals they have in Europe. And, Fab Press does a book that ties in with it every year. And, Harvey runs it. I did my 4 books before that were done with him earlier. And he was like, hey, we want to have you on to do one of our Fright Fest books. And so we talked about possible topics and I was like, I guess let's just we haven't done vampires yet for some reason. Let's do it. Cause I love vampire movies. And, so unfortunately I was finishing the book. I was wrapping it up at the end of 2019. I was supposed to go to UK in 2020 because it's part of my contract. I had to go to Fright Fest in 2020 and you can guess what happened. So,
did something significant happen in 2020?
Yeah, I don't remember. It's kind of fuzzy. I don't know. Something big. So then I had like a lot of time to sort of catch up and go back and polish it and add more movies as they came out, you know, and it's funny, but like a lot of stuff in it still isn't out of date. Cause I drop a reference to the fact, Marvel's still trying to get a Blade movie off the ground. And here we are. And that's still the case.
Still. Well, he showed up in Deadpool and Wolverine. So
yeah, that's true. Yeah. But yeah.
Spoilers so for people that hit for Mark, who has not seen that movie.
I'm not going to see it. So no spoiler.
Mark hates the Marvel movies, so he'll never see it, but Blade's in it. Just so you know.
Yeah. Oh, great.
just fast forward just the Wesley Snipes stuff. It's really funny.
It is pretty great. So let's dive in to your background. What's the first Jack Hill movie you remember seeing, or do you remember?
Spider Baby. That's easy, actually.
Really? Okay.
Nice. Yeah.
Good one.
Yeah. That was a good intro. I was pretty much hooked because I remember it popped up before it ever got restored. Back in the day, there were like labels like Censor Cinema and guys like that would find Princess Spider Baby and they thought it was PD. So anybody would put it out. But that was like, you know, and I think I was maybe like a freshman in high school or something. I mean, I was really young. It was the first one I got my mitts on. And and I just fell in love with it. I was like, this movie's nuts. Like, this is not like any other horror movie I've ever seen. Like, I didn't even know how to process this, because you think, oh, it's Lon Chaney, it's homicidal, killers, blah, blah, blah. It's like, this is just amazing. It was like on a different planet. And right around then, that's about the time that I think Orion Video started putting out Coffee and Foxy Brown, which I'd wanted to see, but you couldn't get your hands on them for a while there. There was a period of like 10 years where you just couldn't see those, and those hit tape. So yeah, anything that, and not like Jack made that many movies, so it was really easy, so you could find anything. But the two we're going to talk about were actually a little trickier until later on when Anchor Bay got them, but those were harder to find. But and well, and not Switchblade, that was Rolling Thunder. But but yeah, eventually those got their moment in the sun. But yeah, the other ones I just kind of had to dig up as they came out on tape, because they never got shown in repertory theaters and things like that. But yeah, Spider Baby was my gateway drug for sure. And actually, the funny thing is, I moved to LA in 1999, and I think that was right when they restored Spider Baby. And so I lived around the corner when I first moved here from the New Art Theater over on Santa Monica Boulevard. And right after I moved there, and they're like, "Oh, we're gonna be showing the restored New restoration of Spider Baby with Jack Hill and Sid Haig and da da da." And I was like, "You've got to be kidding! Like, this is a dream come true." So yeah, I just walked around the corner, and yeah,
That was meant to be.
that's
That's
awesome.
that's cool.
Yeah, I mean, I know I saw which I maybe have mentioned in another episode, but I saw Switchblade Sisters because of Rolling Thunder, and but that was not my first Jack Hill. I think I saw Coffee in a repertory theater in San Francisco called the Red Vic, and then I think those Switchblade Sisters when Jack sort of got on my radar, and that was because of the Rolling Thunder release and a re-release, which I did not realize had happened. But the one I had not seen, and there's a couple movies I hadn't seen until we did this series, one of which was Bloodbath and Mondo Keyhole. But the other one is the first movie we're going to talk about. That was one that I had not seen until now. You did eventually get a copy of that, so you have seen this one before, right?
Oh yeah, oh yeah. I remember. Yeah, when this one, I think the first time this was available to me anyway was when Anchor Bay did the VHS of it, which again was probably like 1999, 2000, somewhere in there. Like there was this flurry of like Jack Hill stuff all of a sudden out of nowhere, like right around the turn of the millennium. So yeah. All of a sudden, these movies that, and I guess because he's talked about Swinging Cheerleaders was almost a lost film, because they almost threw the negative out. He saved like at the last second. So I kind of breaks my heart to think like all these other movies out there like that are gone forever. But at least he saved that one.
Yeah, but as you say also on your review on your site, you said that the copies of it are actually, or at least of Swinging Cheerleaders, have kind of remained the same. Because they've actually done a good job of keeping that negative. I don't know if that has to do with the fact that Frank Moreno owns it or not, but
Well, yeah. I mean, it was kept in good shape to begin with, because no—I mean, apparently nobody touched the thing while it was sitting there for so many years, because they weren't
yeah.
striking prints from it. So, that's the event. If a movie's not popular, it has a better chance of surviving, because it's just going to be immaculate sitting there on that shelf. As long as they don't throw it in a dumpster, like Swinging Cheerleaders, then yeah, that's why even the tape looked really nice. And so now, if they ever do a UHD of it, it should look fine. But you're not going to be like, what a revelation, because it's always,
Right. Well, where we left off in our last episode, Jack had just finished his AIP period with Coffee and Foxy Brown. He was offered at that point in time another movie called Rape Squad, aka Act of Vengeance, but he turned that down. He wasn't happy with the script, and so he didn't want to do that. However, the executive producer of that film is John Pritzer, who was someone Jack had actually met through Roger Corman years before. And Pritzer had produced 1972's Unholy Rollers, which Corman produced as well. And the two had met then with Frank Moreno, who was working for New World Pictures at the time as a sales agent. He was the one who was instrumental in landing Whispers and Cries, or sorry, Cries and Whispers. In fact, I think he was the one that actually he says anyway. He says that he's the one that decided to change the title to Cries and Whispers because it was originally titled Whispers and Cries. So that was Frank Moreno, I guess. So because of Frank Moreno that they made these two movies, because they felt like Frank Moreno could raise the money, which he did. In fact, Jack told Callum in his book, quote, Frank said with the title The Swinging Cheerleaders and my name, he could get financing from sub-distributors, which he did. From then on, it was in my hands. I think he approved the story, but that was a foregone conclusion. It would have had to have been way off for him not to approve it. So basically, he gave him a lot of freedom, much like he had learned from working for Corman at New World Pictures. But yeah, we're going to talk about first. This is essentially Jack's Centaur releasing period, because both of these movies come out from Frank's company. And the very first is going to be 1974's The Swinging Cheerleaders.
The Swinging Cheerleaders, take eight attractive young college co-eds, put them on the cheerleader squad and you have the Swinging Cheerleaders, an action-packed, fun-filled adventure of contemporary college life.
What's the idea of sitting there in the front row with no underpants on like that? Don't you know what that does to me when I'm trying to explain permutations?
The director who created Coffee, the Big Dollhouse, now brings you a view of college life you've never seen, or perhaps you have.
The budget for this, according to John Pritzer and Collins' book, was $165,000.
Wow.
Not bad.
Not bad.
That was their whole budget?
That's the whole budget for this one, yeah, for the Swinging Cheerleaders. So apparently Frank also came up with the title. He came up with the Swinging Cheerleaders title, and they had a script already, but they decided to rewrite it. So Jack rewrote the script, and this is according to John Pritzer, who said that he also then came up with the idea, which was basically about the female journalist who does an expose at the college of the cheerleading, because apparently there's some expose of it. We don't really get into those details in this movie. It is a plot point, but it is a quickly discarded one. And then it goes on to the college football and the sort of fixing of those games. And that becomes the next expose. So it's sort of two exposés. But to me, this movie felt like, and I'm curious what you guys think, but to me, this felt like Jack Hill finally making a nurse's movie. Because it's got like three women, let's say four different women or college students who are going through different issues. We have the one who is sort of going undercover as a cheerleader. And we also have, I guess, Colleen Camp is also a fourth one, sort of, as the leader of the cheerleaders. I don't know. She has a very involved story. She's not in the movie, sadly, as much as I would like. Then we also have another one of the cheerleaders who is having trouble, losing her virginity with her boyfriend, who's also one of the football players. That is Andrea, who played by Rainbow Smith. And then we also have Lisa, plays by Roseanne Caton, who is having an affair with her teacher. And those are the various stories that we're sort of dealing with. But it felt to me very much in the nurses kind of thing, but just a little darker.
Yeah, a lot darker. You can say a lot. It's okay.
Yeah, like it has a lot of the same elements of a nurse's movie. And a lot of those elements haven't aged particularly well. But this one felt dirtier.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like
There's
some real uncomfortable stuff in this one.
Yeah.
Dirtier, but also not that dirty. Like, it got some nudity for sure, but it's not as...
Yeah, it's not as prurient, but it feels...
Right.
Guzzier at the same time, in a way.
Right, right.
There's a lot of implied ickiness, too, that you're like, I'm glad I didn't have to see that. Because even just hearing about it verbally was enough. That was more than enough. But it's also boring. Can I put that out there? I'm sorry. I don't want to start on a negative note, but a few times I was like, I'm bored. And I have these like beautiful ladies.
Sure.
It's a fairly interesting premise, I think, having someone kind of infiltrate the cheerleading squad to, you know, pursue a journalism assignment, but perhaps journalism. Like, it's an interesting premise. And I was like, oh, how much longer?
You also had a character in this movie in Ron, who, as a guy who is bald, there's very few times in my life that I look at another man's hair and I'm not envious. And in this case, I was like, I think if I had a choice between being bald or I had to have his haircut, I'm good being bald. I'm good.
Sometimes it's okay.
Sometimes it's okay.
Well, you mentioned the nurses thing, which is a good point. This is much more like a nurse movie than the other cheerleader movies around that time, because it has that same structure. I mean, I could see someone like Jonathan Kaplan doing the script too. And like those films, the men are very much like footnotes. They're kind of like afterthoughts, and they aren't very useful, which we'll also go into with the next movie as well, with a vengeance. you can sort of see that in this one. I think where this one has a problem, and Jack has actually said this, I don't think he realized how much of an issue it was, but he said when this was brought to him that he not only does he hate football, but he didn't even know how to play it. And I think that's kind of a problem because that's kind of the core sport in the middle of the movie. And he's so disinterested in it that you can sort of feel it a little bit, I think. I think that's why it doesn't quite catch fire as much as the movies he made right before and after this.
Yeah, and he even says in the commentary, he's like, yeah, they're obviously mixing, actual footage of a football game, like the old school Packers uniforms, and they're trying to make their team look like the Packers of old, basically, to have the uniforms. And he's like, yeah, this is obviously stock footage. It doesn't mix in very well, but it's fine. And I was like, yeah, it really does. It does not. It does not. It feels like he just doesn't care enough to worry about it.
Yeah,
So.
it's more glaring than your average World War II B movie. I mean, it really jumps out at you.
Yeah.
I actually had no problem with that, but I
Well,
was like,
if you don't care about football, then
yeah, I
you're not
don't
gonna
care about
bother about
football.
it.
So I
You're
was like,
like, yeah,
this is
whatever. Wake
terrific.
me up when the game's over. Like, I don't care.
I think also in the end, they show the score, and I think they're losing 13 to nothing, but then they say we're down 21 to nothing. And I thought that your shot before showed 13 to nothing. So th that also kind of punctuates the point that he didn't really care.
At all.
And but it is weird that he doesn't, because the movie, like I said, the first plot about, infiltrating these cheerleaders and exposing whatever she was trying to expose gets literally thrown in the garbage can. And then we move
Literally.
on to the fact that they're trying to fix the game outcome of this very good football team and make money off of deliberately losing the game. And so that becomes of the then the second focal point of the movie.
Well, and with the title, it's, I mean, he sort of throws a lot of curveballs at you. You're going to see a movie called Swinging Cheerleaders, and probably half the movie's involved in like the corruption of sports betting, which I don't think you would expect. But again, like in Nurse's film, he also there's a lot about, sexual autonomy, which is kind of a running theme in his movies, but it's really in this one about, women having the right to sort of decide, this is what I want. This is, not letting the guys call the shots about, who they're with and how they want to use their bodies, which is, again, that's kind of a Hill staple as well, which is why I think a lot of people call him a feminist director, which has been a debate for probably 20 years now. But I think it definitely tackles with that more than you would think from that title, because if you're around in the 70s, I was a kid, but I was still aware of it. Around 74, 75, up until 79, people were, for some reason, people were obsessed with cheerleaders, CB radios, and Doberman Pinschers, and I don't know why, but but you have the Dallas Cowboy cheerleaders, which were huge when I was a kid, so they were obvious. That was really on the ascendance, and we had all these cheerleader movies. You had the Cheerleaders, Revenge of the Cheerleaders, the Great American Girl Robbery, or Cheerleaders Wild Weekend, all this stuff. But this one just feels a little different. It's like the cheerleader movie that doesn't really want to be a cheerleader movie.
Yeah, because Jack was said that he was unaware of the cheerleaders, which came out before this. And then this movie comes out, and it ends up being a success, and made a lot of money, and does have Revenge of the Cheerleaders follows, like Pom Pom Girls, I think. There's a bunch of them that kind of come out after this, but he said he'd not seen a movie beforehand, so he was not aware.
Yeah, which is possible.
I think there's another issue of this movie that I think is the reason why it also doesn't catch fire, as you say, Nathaniel, and that is because I think Jack has said many times about this movie, is that they basically got the idea in January and they released the film by May. So they like have an idea, they quickly write the script, they shoot it, they edit it, out it goes in like 6 months. And it definitely feels like a rushed movie because it doesn't have an ending. And it has like
It
really
has end credits.
yeah, it has a freeze frame which you recognize as the end of something, but like it feels more like just a really long first act and a really long second act, and then we end. And there's sort of an ending of, I guess, they expose the trying to fix the game, kind of, but it just doesn't feel like a satisfying ending whatsoever, which feels like a first draft almost. And I know it's not quite a first draft, but it feels like one that you just kind of, we got the script, let's go, let's shoot it, let's cast it, we got it, it's in the can, let's put it out.
Which is not unique to this film. There are other 70s like B movies, I guess you want to call them, exploitation films, that have that kind of feeling as well, where it's like they don't quite get there. One that feels structurally a lot like this movie to me is one called Bonnie's Kids, if you've ever seen that one, where it feels like it's two acts and they kind of just don't get to the third act. It just sort of stops and they roll the credits and you're like, but you're getting to the climax, like, and it just stops. There's a few movies around that time where it's like, if it's good enough, we got enough nudity, we got enough jokes, we got enough action, and we're good. And you're like, wait, but and Jack Hill being such a stickler for dramatic structure, as he talks about, I'm kind of surprised there wasn't maybe a few more drafts get in there. But I don't want to rag on the movie too much because I think the cast is great. I love Colleen Camp. I love Rainbow Smith. The
For
women are
sure.
all perfectly cast. I love seeing them in anything. Rainbow Smith especially, just what a strange career. Like, she did this the same year as she was in Phantom of the Paradise, which is like, what? I mean, it has its good points, but yeah, it's a strange one. In between the Blaxploitation films and Switchblade, it's not where you would think you would have been going.
I just kept thinking the whole time, like, imagine if this is the first movie someone's ever seen. Like, what would they be like? Just happened. I feel like they would walk away with a lot of questions. That's how I kind of left it. I kind of left it like, huh. Like, I didn't hate it. I wasn't like, believe me, there's movies I've hated of New World.
Yeah, I mean, we yeah knew.
That even just thinking about them just boils my blood for no reason at all. This is not one of them. I didn't hate it, but I when it ended, I was like, huh.
Yeah, I mean, to your point, Nathaniel, it feels like a movie that's made for the exploitation drive-in crowd. So they're like, you get it. We're good, right? Like, it has that sort of, we have this unspoken agreement because we're making this movie for a particular crowd who watches particular kinds of movies. And so, if that was your first movie, it would feel real off-putting because you're like, what is this being made for
But if
and
you
to
watched
whom?
it for the first time in a drive-in, you'd be like, all right. I feel like instead of, huh, you'd be like, huh, okay. Does anybody want popcorn? Or I don't know how your drive-in experience was, Ryan, but mine was primarily about snacks.
Yes,
So
mine too.
I
Mine
didn't have a
too.
necessarily kind of
Yeah,
romantic drive-in
wasn't.
experience.
Yeah,
It was
we
more
weren't.
about the snacks.
I'm going to let you in on one of my innermost secrets. Now, instead of taking her out, bring her here and cook dinner for her with some soft music, a little candlelight, and a little wine to mellow her down. It's an absolutely infallible method.
Really?
Never misses.
Yeah, but I don't cook.
Neither can I. No problem. I'll order you my special menu, which will be delivered to your door, ready to eat. All you have to do is splatter a little gravy on your apron, and you're all set.
And Erica, I think to your point, if you had never seen another movie and this was the first movie you'd ever seen, and you'd never had chicken cordon bleu, you'd be thinking, I don't know what that is, but it looks absolutely disgusting.
I didn't know what it was, and he said what it was. And I was like, I don't know.
Well, what I can tell you is it's not chicken cordon bleu.
I agree. And I also think any reservations that she had about sleeping with him were confirmed when he dropped her chicken on the table, picked it up with his hand, and just tossed it back on her plate. I was like, yeah, you were right to hold out. You're
Yeah,
right.
you couldn't have
That was
given her
correct.
the other one. He only pours wine for himself and tries to cheers. He's clearly nervous. But I wonder, like, did he actually use the food service that his buddy recommended? Said, oh, order from Oh,
here?
for
Or
sure.
did he
I
make
think
it
so.
himself?
Yeah,
So
no,
the
he
other thing
absolutely
is,
did.
where are you getting that food from? Because that's not chicken cordon bleu, and I never want to go to that restaurant ever. So,
Well, it's
yeah.
in Mesa. Don't go to don't go to
Beer.
the Le Italiano. It's not what you think. Lay, LAY. First of all, it used to be a mattress store. Now it's an Italian restaurant. It's next to the 7-Eleven.
A lot of the
Also,
same customers
yeah, last
still
at one
go.
point it was a massage parlor. Just don't eat there, all right? But unless you're on a budget, and then just go for it. I don't know.
The
Make your own decisions. You're in college now.
thing that's weird about this movie is that I think, you were talking about Spider Baby. Jack is very capable of making a funny movie.
Oh, yeah.
And this is his comedy. He calls it a comedy. And he also called it a his Disney sex film. So I
Oh,
don't know what that
interesting.
means exactly, but let's go back to the comedy part. He said it's a comedy.
They're all princesses?
I don't know. But the comedy part, it just doesn't feel like a comedy. There's so much more comedy to me in something like Spider Baby than there is in this.
Way more.
And it's that moment where they rush through the door and they all punch the same guy as they all run in that I was like, right, this is a comedy. But I had forgotten it because the movie made me forget that this And so it's interesting that because Jack, I think, can fill his movies with comedy. It's just this one doesn't feel like one.
Well, it doesn't. It's weird because normally a Jack Hill movie will have what I kind of think is sort of like the fist pump moments, like the scenes where the crowd's supposed to go nuts. And a lot of those are comedy moments. If you look at like Foxy Brown, you know pretty early on where he's coming from, like the scene where Pam Grier goes to see her boyfriend when he's had the surgery in the hospital. You know, and as soon as the nurse comes in, she's like, "Well, none of that," and smacking the scene. You know, I mean, it's a really hilarious scene. I mean, the movie's not a comedy, but that scene just, I mean, when you see it with the crowd, it kills. I mean, like, not shut up for like 5 minutes after that scene's over, because and that's why there's just, you know, chatter after that to fill it. But this doesn't have those moments where, you know, where it's you're supposed to go like, "Wah!" Just really get the crowd going. It's all just, yeah, it's all just kind of like there.
And another element is that there's not a lot of characters that you are rooting for. And again, I want to stress, did not hate this movie, but it's like you don't dislike the characters, but you're also not rooting for a lot of them because they're not really doing great stuff. Granted, it's an interesting movie about a slice of college life, like that slice of college life when you're obviously trying to find yourself, and you know you're not exactly always consulting your moral and ethical codes, but
You're dating guys just because they have an off-campus apartment. I get it. I get it.
And so, but it still feels like I don't dig a lot of the people in this movie. Maybe Rainbow Smith, who's, you know, seems like, you know, such an innocent in the whole mix. And I felt bad for Colleen Camp.
I liked all the cheerleaders. You feel bad for the coach to start because you're like, oof, he's in a tough spot, begging for money to kind of bet against his own team. And but then, you know, he turns out to be a little
Total creep. All the
total
guys
creep.
are, you know, the
Total
worst in
creeps.
this movie. But I was into the ladies. Okay, so I'm alone on that one.
Yep. See ya. Bye, Ryan. See you later. It was cool having you. Goodbye.
Fair enough.
Mark and Nathaniel and I are gonna just see you later.
Can I ask, what do you think about the whole expose angle of this? Because I think it's actually, because when the movie starts, you know, you're watching it for like, you're 30 minutes in, you're like, why is it called Swinging Cheerleaders? There's not much swinging going on in this movie. And actually, probably one of my favorite bits is where all of a sudden there's the moment where the expose gets shoved into the camera. You see it's the title of the expose, and you're like, oh, which is kind of a cool little thing. But it's very Jack Hill in a way, because in his movies, a lot of them end up being very, they turn around what you think is going to be the status quo. That he tends, not quite anarchist, but definitely like, he's not on the side that you normally think he is. In this one, it's actually, oh, actually, cheerleading isn't, it does have its positives. It actually can, you know, elevate. You can use it as a springboard to something else, and you know, and actually, maybe sports aren't that bad. And it's actually the older guys, it's the establishment that, you know, on the other side, that's actually the bad guys. Which feels like a Jack Hill idea, but it doesn't quite get as, it doesn't maybe cut as deep as you maybe think it should have.
No, I totally agree. He's always a little anti-establishment, and I think it's probably why he had a difficult time translating outside of exploitation films, because he didn't particularly love the studios. It also was, I think they couldn't name the movie Swinging Cheerleaders, so it was a funny. It's definitely a that's a funny Jack Hill idea to just make that the name of the paper. They had to call it something else in order to cast everything because they couldn't get actors to show up for a movie called Swinging Cheerleaders.
That makes sense, especially at that
But even Jack said to Callum, he said, I can never figure out why he couldn't break into the mainstream. He said, some of my friends made movies that lost money but got good reviews, but they went on to bigger pictures. He at this point with this movie, he makes three hits in a row. Coffee, Foxy Brown, they were huge successes. And he could not get another movie or another mainstream movie. And I think part of that is that sort of anti-establishment streak that he has in him, where he just kind of doesn't. I mean, if you think about his career so far, he's kind of been able to do whatever he wants. So to kind of go into any scenario where he has to appease a studio, he's not going to be cool about, because he's been able to do whatever he felt like. You know, he's rewriting scripts on the fly. He's left alone in the Philippines to shoot a couple movies. He's left alone by AIP to make the movies he wanted. So
I think he was just ahead of his time, honestly.
It's also interesting in the time, like when Quentin Tarantino was really picking up his movies and really talking about the influence that he had on his career. That was a really great window for him to come back and make something and try to take another swing at it. You know, like here was a time when people were talking about him. You had arguably one of the, top five hottest directors that's re-releasing your movies and championing the movies that you made. I'd be curious to know why he didn't kind of grab the reins of that momentum and try to make an take try to make something else, you know? Did Sorceress really, was that really just left such a bad taste that he was like, forget it, it's not worth it.
I think he did try to make stuff for the, I think around that time in the 90s, mid 90s, he was talking about unearthing scripts he had written a long time ago. And he was trying to get those made. And they didn't get made back then. So I think he was just, well, hey, I got this other stuff. Let's get those made. And it's like they weren't, I think Callum sort of talked about this briefly in our first episode. I don't think they were like movies for the 90s, basically. They were, movies for that 70s crowd that time had kind of marched on from. So, but it is amazing that he hadn't got that something didn't happen. Not one thing didn't happen now once his name was back out there. And
Well, it would have gone probably straight to video as a problem. Like, it's the whole financing issue because, like, who would have funded it? Because Miramax probably wouldn't have funded a Jack Hill movie at all. And I mean, there were a few, sort of Tarantino imitators who came out, but like, I don't see Jack Hill making a Tarantino imitation movie just because that's where the money is. I just don't see that happening. And it would have become to VHS, but he doesn't think on that level. So I just think the timing was off. And there are other directors around that time. You got your Russ Meyers and your Radley Metzgers too, who, they wanted to make more movies, but you just couldn't make those kind of movies anymore. Just, audience and the budgets just didn't line up that way anymore.
That's fair.
I wonder too if like Quinn, put out all those movies in Rolling Thunder, but that was also an opportunity for him to try to like start some kind of production company. Losing Roger Corman last year, it was like we're always asking like when's the next Corman going to show up, and there just isn't anybody in that realm. But the only person I could think of who could be in position to get funding, produce movies, and get them out would be somebody like Quentin Tarantino. But it doesn't seem like something he's particularly interested in, which I understand. It's a lot of work too. So,
Yeah, someone would have to just dump money into like a little mini studio or like a streaming service that it's geared to that kind of stuff because the market is there. I mean, you have guys like Scott Adkins are making action movies that are still in that 70s vein, and people love them, but they're not playing in theaters. So,
Can you change that?
I'd love to. Believe me,
Just
I would
change
love
that. It'd be really cool if you
Yeah,
just
because
pull
like the other
some
day, I was pulling
strings.
up the my AMC app and looking at what's playing in the theater, and I was like, you've got to be kidding me. I mean, it was just like nobody would pay money to go see the stuff that's playing right now. Like at all. Sad. I'm just like, come on, just give us some meat and potatoes movies, like something that'll draw the crowd,
And that's really what the movie distributors are saying. Like movie distributors are like, give us more movies. But the studios are only nominating certain things for for actual theaters and then putting the rest on the streaming services. It's like it's not
Except for like freak accidents, like weapons or sinners just pop out of nowhere. Like it almost seems like just sort of like, oops, we forgot to send that straight to streaming. Like, how'd they get in theater? And suddenly it's huge. And like, oops,
Well, that's horror has really kind of managed to, I think, keep things alive, That's something that like, if Jack had also gone in a horror direction more often than not, I think he also could have gotten a lot more out of that as well. Like he didn't outside of, a few of his movies, he kind of goes in horror, Spider Baby, and some of that he certainly delves into that realm, but largely he didn't do horror movies.
Which is a shame.
Depending on your thoughts on Sorceress. But
That is a complex topic.
but yeah, he probably could have gotten more work, but I just don't know if that was what he was interested in.
Although weirdly, I think the person who's closest to Jack right now, now the Coen brothers have split up and going solo, but if you look at like Honey Don't and Drive Away Dolls, those are kind of like stabs at making modern day Jack Hill movies
Yeah, that's
in a way.
true.
Like,
That's
that's
a
really
great
true.
point. That's a great point.
Yeah, I have not seen Honey Don't yet, but Driveway Dolls, I was like, oh, you really can see what where Ethan had an influence on the Coen Brothers movies. It's like, oh, okay, see, I see what you have, what you added to this mix.
Yeah, I wonder if Jack has actually seen those, if he sees a similarity. But I mean, Jack, at least from my encounters with him, Jack is not like a bitter person. But I wonder how he felt in the way that, I mean, he made like the most important, greatest women in prison movies, and all of a sudden, Jonathan Demme comes right after him. Does he does Caged Heat? He works on Hot Box, and suddenly he's the guy doing all the Oscar-winning movies. And it's like, wait, what? Like,
Well, he also started out with Coppola,
Yeah.
you know, and he like made like Nudie Cuties with him and stuff. And like all of a sudden Coppola's winning all these Oscars in the 70s. It's like, hold on. You know, he took like basically the ending of Jack Hill's student film and made it into the ending of Apocalypse Now. It's like, wait, you know.
And he stole Colleen Camp for Apocalypse Now, too.
That's right. Yes, he did. Yeah. Yeah, so this one though, still a big success, Swingin' Cheerleaders. And it's really the next movie that actually kind of makes it way more difficult for Jack to transition to studio movies. And that is 1975 Switchblade Sisters.
Meet the toughest gang of teenage girls ever to slash their way across a motion picture screen. Their parents didn't want them. Their teachers were scared of them. Even the cops couldn't tame them. Switchblade Sisters. Are they young rebels fighting for survival in a decaying society? Or are they just teenage hoodlums taking advantage of their youth?
It can't hold us. We're juveniles.
This is one that I is one of my favorites. I really, really love this one. Like, I can understand people don't quite get into this one, but for me, this is just a ton of fun.
Who are these people, and can we go talk to them and show them the error of their ways?
Yes, I know. I don't know. I don't, yeah. And it surprisingly was not a hit. And we'll get into that in a second. But with the Swingin' Cheerleaders, a big hit, they moved forward with this movie because they wanted to do a movie about a gang. I think that's Frank Marino who says, like, let's do a movie about a gang. And Jack insisted it be about a female gang. And he also then thought, oh, what about Shakespeare's Othello as inspiration? Now, where that got into the mix, I don't know. And it's a very loose interpretation of Othello, if anything. But
I have serious issues with the Othello thing, but we'll get into
I
that.
don't, he always talks about it, but I'm like, I don't know, man. I'm not sure. It's originally titled The Jezebels. That's what it was originally released as. I think actually, you know, as a lot of New World movies and a lot of exploitation movies, they start out in one territory and then they see how well they do and then they go to the next. And apparently, I think in that first place when they played as the Jezebels, it didn't do very well. But they were getting money back from the second place where it did better, but they had already decided to re-release it as Switchblade Sisters, which I love as a title, quite frankly. I kind of prefer it.
It's a better title.
Yeah, I
Yeah,
mean, I think
screw title.
it's a lot, and it
Yeah.
says a lot more about the kind of fun that Jack is having in this movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's not anticipating. The Jezebel seems a little bit more serious, and the Switchblade Sisters feels like, oh, this is okay, this is gonna be some fun.
Well, but it's the title you want to hear somebody say in the trailer. You want to hear that guy going, Switchblade Sisters. You know, Jezebel's just
Yeah.
Yeah.
Frank Moreno again has it releases this through Centaur Releasing. They have 18 days this time to shoot, a budget of 320,000.
Wow.
At this point, Frank Moreno has even left New World, and he's kind of making a go of Centaur Releasing. They had released a bunch of foreign films, as well as Invasion of the Bee Girls, which we spoke to Jeff Scheckman about because he worked on that movie. So who takes Moreno's place at New World Pictures? Robert Remy, who would run
Yeah.
New World in the 1980s after Corman sold the company. So he's the one who takes place as the sales manager. So Jack did do some rewriting on this. He doesn't do the initial draft of the script. I also think that's something to do with this movie and kind of makes it stand out a little bit is that he doesn't really write the script, I believe, because he was going on a honeymoon. Who they get to write it, however, is somebody who's FX Mauer, Mayer, who doesn't write another movie. Is that a pseudonym for somebody? I'm not sure. But I do think it gives the movie it's a slightly different. It's got some Jack Hill moments, but I think the fact that somebody else wrote it kind of makes it feel just a little bit different to me.
It was me, guys. It's
Oh, you did
time
it?
that
You did it.
I just reveal myself.
Oh, wow.
It was me, old
You
FX.
have kept that a secret for a long time. I really got to hand it to
Kept
you.
it
That was
a
really.
secret for my, some would say before my life began.
Yeah. Some real in utero script writing on your part. But the one thing about this that I did not even know as many times as I've seen this until really I saw, until I started looking into this for this episode, Did you guys know that this was set in a futuristic society?
Wait, what?
What?
No.
No.
Yeah. He
Huh?
intended this to be just slightly ahead in some sort of futuristic time. Not exactly an apocalyptic, but a futuristic time, which is why the school eventually closes down and they just combine the kids, and you're supposed to look around and see this. All the, you know, the graffiti on the walls and everything is supposed to seem like this is like a kind of warriors type world where the gangs are kind of running things and everything.
I'm just glad that in the future we still roller skate. I'm so pleased. That's
Yeah.
wonderful news. I can't wait, honestly, for it then. I can't wait for this timeline.
Nothing says badass gang like roller skating. Like,
Right? I
yeah,
mean, but
nothing
think
strikes
about it.
fear
Think
into
about
the
it. At
hearts and
our age,
minds.
on
Yeah.
skates,
Oh,
and we
terrifying.
tumble. Goodbye,
Yeah.
ankles. Goodbye,
Yeah.
goodbye, knees. See
Yeah.
ya. I need a
Right.
full
Yeah.
I need a full leg
Hips
reconstruct.
gone. Yeah.
Done.
Yeah.
Tailbone? Forget about it.
Evident.
I'm sitting on a ring for months.
Evidently, in the future, you can go to high school into your 30s.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's all about learning now. The learning never stops.
Got it. Okay.
Well,
Okay.
the funny thing is that they did try to cast younger people. In fact, on the Blu-ray, they do talk to the casting director, who mentions that they were looking at Terry Nunn potentially
Oh,
for a lead
yeah.
role, but she was 16 years old at the time. So they then, when you have actual kids, then they have to do school for part of the day. They have all that different stuff. So they didn't want to have to do that. They only had 18 days. More than the swinging cheerleaders, but still not a ton of time to make a movie. So,
That's wild.
but that said, they do cast a bunch of, especially the guys, and they do make fun of, one of the
They make
characters,
fun of oh, it's
Krabs.
Crabs, how long are you going to be in high school?
Right.
Yeah.
So Krabs is supposed to be a guy that's been there forever and ever. However, it's like, and is apparently attending colleges with his two uncles, or sorry, high school with his two uncles. Because the two guys behind him are like have
Yeah.
mustaches.
That whole gang is ancient.
They are clearly old dudes.
When they were told to show up at the roller rink, I was like, "You guys sure? I mean, without knee
Like...
pads, bold choice. Bold.
Yeah,
Bold.
no elbow pads, no wrist
Yikes.
guards. I mean,
Oof.
come on.
It
You say
shows
so.
how dedicated they are to danger, you know?
You don't even need to bring the guns, just wait long enough.
Just walk out there in socks. Good luck.
Something's gonna pop. Something's gonna pop. But like all the guys in this movie look way past high school. Not to even go into some of the women that they cast as well. So I guess that's just something you have to kind of put behind you. Robbie Lee, though, taking the main role as Lace.
First, you'll meet Lace. She's as affectionate as a scorpion, with all the loving tenderness of a buzzsaw.
Who had been in Big Bad Mama for New World. Joanne Neal, who plays Maggie, and is terrific in this movie.
Then there's Maggie, Lace's best friend, a shapely young bundle of female dynamite, and Lace's man lit the fuse.
She was like a New York stage actress who'd done Shakespeare, so
Othello, maybe, or
no, but and she's been very courteous in interviews, but I'm like, she had to call some bullshit on the Othello thing. I don't know. She knew Shakespeare. Like, I don't know. I don't know about that, man. And then, of course, Monica Gale as Patch.
And then there's the one they just called Patch.
I lost my eye for this gang, remember? We used to be tough.
Who is the Iago in the story? I guess Jack had been served a compliment by Quentin Tarantino that Patch was, in his eyes, Tarantino's, that is, like the best portrayal of Iago in a movie.
Okay.
All right.
Well,
I mean, maybe in the 70s. I don't
I would
know.
actually argue that I think Patch and Lace are both Iago in different ways. Because
Yeah.
it doesn't line up with Othello really at all.
No.
Because because then that would mean Dom is Desdemona, which is like, and it all gets really
It just, yeah.
trying to correlate it. So, but yeah, I think Lace and Patch sort of like split the role in a way, because Lace is always manipulating and covering it up and all that, but then Patch is sort of egging her on and misleading her. So it's kind of like two Iagos
Yeah.
playing off each other. But
Yeah.
to me, this feels more like a love story between Lace and Maggie that they're trying to deny But that's really what it is, because they have the most chemistry in the movie. Like when they're together, it's just like fireworks. You know, which is where I think the whole Othello thing falls apart, because you kind of want these girls like make up and get together at the end of the movie.
I love Robbie Lee, and all of her lines are just so quotable. My friends and I that saw the movie in the 90s, like, we said
everybody's gotta be in a gang
all the time. Like, that was just something we always quoted, because I mean, it's just, she's just got such memorable lines in there, and she's got like all this grit, and Maggie's just trying to, you know, Joanne Nail's trying to keep it all together and keep them, you know, glued in, and then she got, by the end, becomes, you know, this big revolutionary by the end of the movie. But I was this the first time for you guys seeing this movie?
Yes
it was. Yeah,
if you haven't seen this in a theater, like if they ever bring it back in, this is a great crowd movie. Because like I was saying about the Foxy Brown scene, but the scene in this one, it starts off, you know, with the theme, you know, it starts off and you're like, okay, I'm getting in the vibe. But the minute that guy steps in the elevator and all the girls keep getting on one floor after floor, and it's like, that's when people are just like, oh shit, oh, here it comes. And like, when on the movie just has you, like, it does not let you go from that point. It is such a great, great audience movie.
Yeah.
They go and hang out at a burger place, which is now the Oinkster. Mm-hmm. Which is a place out in Eagle Rock. And but I love that scene, because that landlord shows up and he's been with his torn clothes, and he's in like that blanket that clearly the police have given him a blanket.
But he's still wearing the shredded shirt, like the shredded pieces.
Yeah. And they're like, are you sure you want to press charges? He's like, yeah. And he like covers himself in the blanket. And I'm like, that is pure Jack Hill comedy right there. That is absolutely his kind of funny. Yeah. Let's talk about some of our favorite moments in this one. The roller skating rink fight that you talked about. It is such a great scene. They had a day to shoot it, which is just insane. Dominic didn't know how to skate. So
really?
Yeah.
Wow. And Robbie Lee shows off that she actually really knew how to skate. She's all skating backwards and everything.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. Oh,
this is not her first time at the roller rink.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Asher Brauner, who plays Dominic, did not know. So they were like pulling him. Something they built something for him to basically
that
stand
seems
on.
So much more dangerous than just trying it. Like being pulled on skates seems like my nightmare.
Nowadays they have those like little rolling walkers that you
can
use.
Yeah, they should just given him a little walker.
Yeah.
That would have been actually rad if he just had that in jail. Like they did, they showed it. They like went to a longer shot.
Don't say anything.
Like, this guy didn't know how to skate, guys. Shut up, everybody. I don't know how to skate.
This movie also has one of easily the top 10 most potentially terrifying things that could ever happen to me. And that is having someone forcibly put a plunger on my face. That I would lose. I would have the highest pitched scream that I've ever emitted if that happened to me.
So, but it would be so muffled because that plunger would be on your face.
Right.
More so than getting your head dunked in the toilet?
I had swirlies done to me when I was in elementary school. You know, it's the water. The plunger is, it's a whole different kind of
situation.
You only get that guy out when you're in trouble.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
There's ghost poops on that. Yeah.
It's got a lot of ghosts on it.
Yeah.
They're just on your face now.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Rubber doesn't forget.
Right.
So you're going to get a whiff of all those.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
At least in terms of the Blu-ray, when they go back, they visit some of the sets and they go back to the roller rink and it was still there. I didn't get to double check today and see if it's still there today, but at
it
least
still there.
Is it still there?
Still there in Burbank. Yep.
Oh my gosh. That's amazing.
Thank goodness.
Awesome.
So in the future, we can still roller skate there.
Yes. Oh,
yes.
Yeah.
Woo! Woo! I also like in the future that I'll have that sort of little hand whip with the
and then she wears a belt.
Metal balls on the end of it. I'm going to get one of those.
Just for protection. I'm
definitely going to wield one of those because I'm absolutely going to be trying to just enjoy a hamburger by myself in the future. Someone's going to be like, you and a gang? I'm going to be like, ah, here we go. Let me just, give me a minute. Let me stand up.
I thought it was interesting in this movie that this is, as far as I can tell, one of the only movies that Jack Hill shot that he's using, what, they're on the Universal lot? Like,
MGM.
Just everything else, MGM.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was really interesting because almost everything else he does is, you know, out on streets and what have you. So
it reminded me, I thought at first it was the Fox Lot because the Fox Lot still has a lot of those streets in there. But apparently this was like the New York sets that were on the MGM lot. And this was, I think, the last movie to shoot on Lot 2. At the MGM lot for whatever reason, but they had tons of standing sets so you could shoot anything there. It does look amazing. That end, the big end battle is fantastic. And it's one of the better things that Jack has done, I think, in his career.
Where you're waiting for like tanks to start rolling through at any minute. It's interesting because that's why you're saying it's set in the future. It's hard to tell because I guess maybe he's going for like a Soylent Green, like Damnation Alley kind of vibe that it looks a little, but the MGM lot was actually falling into disrepair at the time. Like that's why it was so cheap to get it. But that, I think this was shot back to back. There was a made for TV movie called Phantom of Hollywood that was shot around the same time, which is out, Warner Archives put it out. It was entirely shot in that lot. It's about like, you know, a family opera set on the lot as it's being torn down. If you watch that back with Switchblade Sisters, they're using the same streets and they look almost the same. And it's really weird when you think about these two different crews making this movie, these are movies at the same time. But if you're a fan of Switchblade Sisters, check it out. Cause it's almost like a behind the scenes version of that movie.
Oh, cool.
That's really cool.
Did you first see this movie in the theater or did you have to see it on home video?
I did when it got reissued. Yeah. When Rolling Thunder put it out, I saw it. Cause it was for some reason, even though normally these were free like art house films, Rolling Thunder stuff got released outside of like, you know, New York and LA. So like Switchblade Sisters and The Beyond and Detroit 9000, all this stuff, they played at least at midnight, like in all the major cities. I don't know how they pulled it off, but they did it. So yeah, so I did go see like a midnight show of this with a crowd and yeah, it was amazing. And you know, every time it's a different video form up and show it to friends and it's always a hit.
Yeah.
And Jack Hill movies, and the very best ones that he does, there's always kind of like these interesting little moments where that suggests something that like a backstory to his characters a little bit. And this movie's loaded with it. You're talking about favorite scenes in this movie. And I think one of my favorite bits that nobody ever talks about ever, but I love, there's this little quiet moment when Maggie takes him to go see Muff, you know, Marlene Clark, you know, with the black girl gang. And there's that cool moment where another girl, which comes to Maggie, and she's like, so how did you meet Muff? And she's like, oh, I was dating her brother until the cops took him out. And they both kind of go, oh, and they kind of look down. And does that slow fade to black. It's like this really eerie moment. It's really haunting the way they pull it off. I don't want to know like what, like I want to see that movie. Like what is the Muff and Maggie story?
Yeah.
Obviously yeah. You could build like a Romeo and Juliet movie out of that. So.
Inspired by Shakespeare kind of movie.
Yeah. And not a West Side Story version. We're talking like the Jack Hill version of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Marlene Clark, who was in New World's Night of the Cobra Woman, who was in this movie just very briefly, but great.
So what do you want?
We need some help. Me and my girls here were the Dagger Debs, and now we're the Jezebels.
No men.
Cowards. We kicked them out.
Good. Now that's real good. You know, sooner or later, every woman's bound to find out. The only thing a man's got below his belt is clay feet.
Mark, going back to the ending fight, that car tank, I had to think that you were into the little car that they turn into a tank in that one. Were you impressed with that as a car?
Yeah, I mean, the car was sort of inconsequential, but I liked what they did with the car because it harkened back to how they would reinforce and... reinforced the cars in Escape from New York. It had that same kind of look to it, which I mean, I don't know if this movie had an influence on Escape from New York because there were definitely some shared reinforcement of the front windshield and being able to come up through the top. And I was like, okay, this is very reminiscent. It's funny that you said that this was supposed to be set in the future because it was the only time in the movie that I thought, well, that's an odd thing to do to your car, even in the 1970s, you know, and in a time when, you know, you would jack up your car or you'd paint a you'd airbrush a Pegasus on the side of your van, you know, like the customizing your car was really big back then, but sure. That was not the kind of customizing that was being done. But I thought it was a really cool touch, and I loved their reaction of like, what is that when it comes rolling up on them? So yeah, I mean, and that end fight scene is awesome. So well done.
Yeah. It's a real blast. And I think one thing that John Pritzer says about working with Jack Hill is that he was so meticulous with how he storyboarded everything, because you don't have a lot of time to mess around when you only have 12 and 18 days. And I think that that's something that, certainly going back to Corman, that was something that Corman always stressed, was like, you got to know exactly how you're going to shoot this before you get into it, because you don't have time to mess around. Also, he didn't want you to take too many takes. So you had to go very quickly, and you kind of had to know what you were doing to step into it. Otherwise, you know, you're going to be burning money. So, and it really shows in that end action scene that I think he really knew how he was going to do it. And that's a lot of moving parts to kind of deal with, because it's a lot of actors. There's, you know, a lot of stunts and coordinating all that. And I think he does a really good job with it, which he didn't do a lot of big, not at least big wide action scenes like that too often.
Has he talked yet? We're just getting acquainted.
Come on, Lace. We gotta go. There's no time.
Not before we get some information.
No, wait! Don't shoot! Please! I'll tell you anything.
You son of a bitch! He was an attack!
He was going for his gun. He could have killed you.
Yeah, pretty convenient. What do you mean, convenient?
Was there another favorite moment that you had, Nathaniel, or?
Oh, God, wow. There's so many, but... well, I do want to say that one character I love in this is Donut. I really love her so much.
I do,
like, I'm like, can somebody just give her a hug? Like, every time they put her down, I'm just like, stop it. I mean, she's so sweet and so pretty, and it's like, just come on. But, you know, the scene where Lace, like, she trashed her for asking for more food at the burger joint, I'm just like, oh, poor Donut, she just wants to eat lunch. Like,
Lace, if the debts are paid, you think I could have a double cheeseburger with some french fries and a coleslaw?
What?
I'm really hungry.
Oh, she's hungry. Look out!
I caught a piggy!
What'd I do, Lace?
It's funny that, too, because Robbie Lee sort of plays a version of Donut in Big Bad Mama, and here she is playing, like, the total aggressor in this one, which is actually played by Kitty Bruce, which Jack had met her dad when he was working in, you know, clubs, you know, just like a cabaret clubs doing comedy, Lenny Bruce, and met him way back then. So he said he met Kitty first when she was a baby.
Aww. Oh, wow. Oh, that's awesome.
I know. Apparently, he said that Kitty wasn't a super big fan of her role in this movie, but which, you know, it's probably not a lot of fun every day to always be the one yelled at.
Yeah.
But she's great in this. I agree. She's really great in this.
Yeah. Like, I mean, she's honestly like, if I had to just hang out with somebody in this movie, she'd probably be my pick. Like, I would just love to sit down and just have a meal with her, because you just like her, you know? She doesn't have a lot to play with. She doesn't have a huge part, but like, every time she pops up, you're just like, oh. Hey, Donut, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, totally.
So the movie doesn't do very well at the box office. Jack says it could be the R rating that killed it, because it raised people's expectations.
Yeah. I got to talk about that. Because, in the making of, like, when he gets interviewed about this, he talks about how he thinks it was unfair because they thought they were making this for a movie that kids could go see, and that they got an R because of Narcotics. And I'm like, I'm going to go back and watch the movie again, because there's at least 4 topless nude scenes. There's a lot of F-bombs.
Yeah.
Bloody bullet squibs. I'm like, this is a pretty hard R. So
Yeah. I mean, even for the 70s and 80s, when, you know, you didn't have PG-13 for at least most of the 70s and then part of the 80s. So there was really no middle ground. So you could get away with a great deal in a PG, but it still feels like, drugs or no, I don't think you're gonna get a PG out of this.
Yeah, as soon as they drop the motherfucker, it's like, that's an R. That's automatic. You can't say that in a PG ever.
And I also question, like, did you really think kids were gonna go see this? Does Frank Moreno say, hey, let's make a movie about a gang for kids? You know, like, I can't imagine that being a part of the calculus from the beginning of this movie. It just, I can't see. Look at what they just did. Swinging Cheerleaders. They're all from pretty much from working with New World or working in exploitation and AIP. I mean, John Pritzker is the guy who had produced Rape Squad. They're like, let's make a gang movie for children. I mean, this isn't Bugsy. Like, I don't think this is not. I don't
Same.
know.
Yeah, I mean, if you did take a kid to see this, you have to do some explaining. Like when they're prostituting one of their own in a high school bathroom. There's some conversation that has
Yeah,
to
you're
take
like, I'm
place at
preparing you
the
for the future because this is what it's going to be like. We're going to watch this. We're going to watch Switchblade Sisters, and then we're going to go roller skating, and then I need a nap. But you're going to be prepared for the future.
Good luck explaining what the whole juvie warden wants from one of the girls, from Maggie, when she gets in there.
Oh,
That's
geez,
what yeah.
I had until now blocked that out. Yeah, that's.
Yeah, for sure.
That's what I kind of love about this movie, though. It does take some chances and go some directions that Jack had not done with, like wider action scenes. But we dip into some of the other stuff that he's dealt with before, including we get a little bit of like a women in prison movie just very briefly in this movie.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no way he doesn't think about that. And, I
Yeah.
mean, he's.
This would have been a women in jail, just for clarity.
Sorry, yes,
Okay.
yes, thank you, Mark.
Yeah.
So prison is a much longer sentence than
Yeah.
this is a jail because they're all minors. Minors. I mean,
Well, there's
they're all clearly a lot older than 18, but still they're or 17, I should say. It's still strange to me this doesn't do well. It is weird. I think if when you're saying it's probably the R rating, it's because they just don't know how this did badly. They just don't know. I think this is the superior film in many, many ways. Are inarguably than Swingin' Cheerleaders, and that was a huge hit. So I just think they marched into this with so much confidence and just can't imagine what happened.
Yeah, especially given that this kind of movie with gangs and rivalries, that was a very common theme. If it's not explicitly gangs, but having big rivalries between groups. And I hate to say it, but because this seems so obvious, but in the 1970s, switchblades were hella cool. And that was a thing. So you got women, you got switchblades, like all the pieces seem to be there to like perfectly packaged up for a 19 early 19 early to mid 1970s audience. Why it isn't successful, I have no idea, because it should. I mean, this is perfect.
You're talking about Jack Hill being ahead of the curve, but it's funny because, 4 years after this, you get the Warriors, which it's,
Exactly.
I think I think it just came out the wrong time, because I think it had to come out a little later. If this has been like the same, if this had come out right after the Warriors, it would have been huge.
And he seemed to set the table so often. Like a Spider Baby seems to set the table for Texas Chainsaw Massacre in many ways, or this crazy killer family. Not that it was the very first women in prison movie, but Big Doll House, all of a sudden everyone's making these movies after that. But sometimes he was just too ahead of his time. I feel like that's what this one was. Though he does say that even when it was released in the 90s, when you saw it, Nathaniel, that it didn't do still as well as they were hoping. And I think because Miramax thought it was going to be a huge hit, it did very well though in home video, and it did, had a lot of success there. I know Jack felt a little bit of like, okay, got him, it did get embraced.
Well, one of the mistakes that I think Rolling Thunder made when they did these movies, because this was actually across the board, not just this one, but with Detroit and the Beyond, all these movies that all the reissues that they did, but they ran them at midnight, but they also screened them for all the major mainstream critics, which I think was a huge goof, because if all of a sudden Roger Ebert's reviewing and he's giving all of them 1 star and saying, oh, this is amateur hour, these movies are inept, da da da. It's like that is not who you show these to. That's not who gets the word out at all. This is kind of Ain't It Cool News hadn't really quite kicked in. So there wasn't really a sounding board to get the word out, which was the problem. And so, but I think they thought that all of a sudden New York Times was going to get these rave reviews and say, oh, these are undiscovered classics. And that didn't happen. So it actually took home video where people really started passing these around and being like, oh, these movies, this is incredible. You got to watch this. And you watch it with your friends, and that's how the word of mouth spread. But yeah, I think the way they promoted it, that they kind of missed it a bit. They thought, well, Tarantino's cool and critics like his movies, therefore they're going to like these movies. And that's not what happened.
Hi, I'm Quentin Tarantino, and I'm here to introduce the Rolling Thunder Video Collection.
World-famous director Quentin Tarantino brings his passion for movies and his experience as a celebrated filmmaker to an exciting new video line.
If you like my stuff, you can look at it and like, this is where it came from.
Yeah, it kind of didn't happen and didn't take off. Like even Detroit 9000, that did not get like another release until just recently, and that's still a foreign. It got released on a foreign Blu-ray.
Yeah, only in Australia.
Yeah, which is, I mean, it kind of had that resurgence at that time, and then it kind of got forgotten again, which is kind of crazy.
Yeah, everybody fucked up. Fucked up. I hear you. Oh yeah, he's back. Ryan's back. We can welcome him back into the fold now.
Okay, good. Oh,
Back.
thank you. Oh, whew.
Get it back, but you can get back in.
It's a bummer to me though that this is the movie that kind of ends up killing his career to some degree, because this makes things very difficult for him. He told the Boston Globe in 1996, he said, "After Switchblade Sisters, my career was over and my life changed." And it's like, why one dud? I feel like there's more to it. What happened? And I think we'll dive in a little bit in the next episode. But Nathaniel, what are your thoughts? What do you think happened?
I think that he was used to making them a certain way, and you'll notice that when he talks about AIP, the reason he left AIP after those was because, the imposition of it, the fact that the commercial expectations were something that he just, wasn't happy with after a while, even though obviously Coffee and Foxy were massive, massive hits. And he thought that he could sort of keep his approach going. And unfortunately, as we know, like by the late 70s, there was a big shift. This was post Jaws by this point. Star Wars is coming up. It just doesn't click anymore. So who's going to fund this kind of stuff? That's the problem. You've got Coppola's off making Apocalypse Now. Scorsese's making New York, New York. I mean, where does Jack Hill fit into that? I don't know.
Right. Yeah. And it took a lot of pivoting on Corman's part to even figure out where to go with New World Pictures. I mean, the product they start putting out after, not only just after Jaws, which obviously they made Piranha and Up from the Depths. I mean, let's not forget some really classic Jawsploitation films.
Humanoids from the Deep, I guess, kind of qualifies, even though it's not a nautical monster, but yeah.
Right.
Yep.
It's not a fish, but it's people, but yeah, it's still a Jaws
Yeah,
ripoff.
but like he starts figuring out how do I deal with like this Jaws and Star Wars landscape that you're talking about, and but that wasn't the case for most everyone, even especially AIP, who could not figure out how to live in a non-drive-in landscape. I think it killed a lot of careers. So I think you may be right on that. Any last thoughts, Nathaniel, about these movies before we call it a day?
Yeah, I mean, just to we didn't really go into the whole Othello thing, but can we just go into that for
Oh,
a second?
please, yes.
Yeah,
Yes,
for
yes,
sure.
yes.
Because they keep, they hammer that home, how Shakespearean this movie is, how Othello it is, which, I mean, very vaguely maybe the same theme. But if Patch is Iago, don't you find it kind of weird that Patch doesn't really have any comeuppance aside from, oh, you're not in her gang anymore? It's like, okay, but there's no real payback, because I mean, she's kind of the main villain of the movie, and then she's just sort of like, she's the one who doesn't go to jail and she's out of the gang, and you're like, strange, probably realistic. I mean, that is probably how it would go down. But so that's where the Othello thing, I'm not so sure about it, because Iago dies horribly at the end of the play.
Right.
Sure, I'm like, I can't quite square the two together. So yeah, I
and
don't.
I just don't know if it felt like being out of the gang would have been such a like painful thing for one of the gang members to be kicked out of the gang that it would feel like a death in a way. Like maybe that's what he was going for, but it doesn't feel like that moment. It doesn't feel like she's like, God, without this gang, I have nothing. And you're kicking me out of this gang and I have nothing. It doesn't feel like that.
No, it doesn't land that
It
at
doesn't
all.
land in that way, to your point.
Yeah, I mean, she looks bummed out, but it seems like
Like she
for all the stuff
lost
she
one of
pulled.
her eyeballs for that gang.
Right.
That should have been a moment of like, you're out of this. Like, just that's it.
Maybe she should have fought to like, no, I am a part of, if she fought harder and we could have seen how much it mattered to her. But yeah, it does feel like they let that. I also think like if this was inspired by Othello, that was something you thought of while you were writing it and thought, I could use little bits and pieces of that and keep it interesting. And he always says he wrote the scripts really for the actors to give them something to play. So maybe that, he's dealt with a lot of stage actors. So referencing Shakespeare to them was always something that I think resonated. But it definitely feels like this isn't inspired by Othello. It does not feel like it.
I mean, this goes further back. I mean, there's a movie called Teenage Gang Debs that was made way back in the, it was made in black and white way before that, which is like it's like the gang, the girl gang version of Macbeth, which is what they called it, which is like loosely, but that was the big selling point, because in the press book they're like, oh, and credit to William Shakespeare. It's like, come on, really? Like, a little bit, but any, if it's about a gang and the leader goes down at the end, therefore it's like Macbeth, or it's like, come on, what is it, King Lear 2? Like, what? It gets a little silly, but I mean, if that's how they want to sell it, that's fine. But yeah, I mean, I do think the fact that the script, I don't think the script was probably rewritten when they cast the older actors because everybody is so emotional and heightened. It's like they talk like they're 15-year-olds.
For sure. Yeah.
I think it's kind of interesting. That's why it almost feels like it does feel like this movie's on a different planet because it's like they never grew up, you know? So it's kind of interesting. Mm-hmm. As opposed to like Grease, where you're just sort of like, you know, why is Craterface like 45 years old? Like, this doesn't make any sense, you know? And John, you know, why is Danny like his early 30s? Like, you know, they've been shaving for over a decade. This is bizarre. But it kind of works in this movie, though, because it feels like they're in this sort of stunted thing where they're all still just like freaking out over, you know, these little trivial things. But yeah, so I think that's why it kind of works. And I'm kind of glad that they kept that idea, even if they had to cast older actors to play these parts.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it feels like a futuristic society, but it definitely feels like it's its own little world. Yeah. And I'm very quick to not care about having a lot of older authority figures. And, you know, there we do get to see Maggie's mom a little bit and that situation that she's trying to keep them in that apartment and the landlord and, you know, everything else. But we get the cops, but we don't get a lot of adults. It's really just around the world of these kids where they're sort of able to go. And I got sucked into it. So I don't really seem to worry about it because Jack's very good at like just getting you into, you know, his characters and the drama of it.
Yeah, and the adults in this movie are terrible, by the way. Because at the end of the movie, when they cut to the cops outside and the guy's like, no, hang on, let's wait till they kill somebody. And then we can go in. You're like, Jesus Christ. I'm like, really?
Yeah. There's no good adults. Maybe the teacher, the
principal, maybe, that tries to broker a deal.
Maybe.
Sort of, yeah. But it's so ineffective and it doesn't, you know in the moment it's not going to work.
Yeah.
For sure.
So.
And I do, as I was watching it, I was thinking, and I guess I just must be dense, and so I didn't read into this being in the future, but I was thinking, like, where do these people live? They're all just hanging out in this. They're all hanging out drinking Coors in an abandoned warehouse. Where are their parents? Shouldn't they be home? But I didn't, I guess, put enough stock into that thought to think, okay, maybe there's something else going on here that they're not explicitly saying, but they're expecting you to connect the dots yourself. I just stupidly did not connect those dots. I just went, oh, wow, where are the parents? Huh, moving on.
I do think that's true. I did think about like where the parents are a little bit, though we do get, like I said, Maggie's mom. But it doesn't throw me about where they are because it's just, and this is only because we live in LA, but it's like, well, we're in Eagle Rock, Pasadena. I mean, this is pretty clear from a lot of these locations. It's pretty obvious where they are, you know? But it just looks like almost try to be anywhere, bad neighborhood kind of city, big city, you know?
For sure. A terrible neighborhood of Pasadena.
You
gotta be real careful in that town.
Those are some mean streets.
If their parents were anywhere outside of Pasadena, they were like, yeah, figure it out. I'm not driving out there. Forget it. Nope. Not right now.
This is where...
You can go to jail because I am not taking the 134 at 5 p.m. You're nuts. Fuck you. I hope you have your switchblade. Take care of yourself.
This is what happens when the parents drop off their kids and they need to go to the farmer's market in Pasadena. And they're like, you can go wherever. Just be back here by 5.
Yeah.
But Nathaniel, thank you so much for being here.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you so much.
It was so awesome to have you. We're such big fans of you and your work. And it was such a thrill.
Likewise. Love your podcast.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Seeing that you reviewed the Grant Land of Small and mentioned us in that review on your site was like such a thrill. That was so cool.
You're the only other person who's ever talked to me about that movie.
Same with us. It was such a, you know, from the beginning of doing an episode on this movie where we're like, no one's going to know this thing ever. Yeah. No one's ever heard of this movie. And then to get it onto a disc and then to have it get reviewed, it's like, what's happening? Never in a million years would I have thought that that our episode would have traveled that far for sure. So, but it was great having you. Thank you so much for being here. Hopefully we can have you back on at some point in the future.
Love to. Thank you so much.
Yeah. And tell people where they can find all your work and your book and everything else.
Yeah, absolutely. So you can find me at mondodigital.com. That's mondo-digital.com. My book is available from any major retailer of your choice, as well as the four preceding it. And you can hear any of my gazillions of commentaries out there all over the globe. So They're very easy to find.
They are plentiful. I have so many Kinos down here that are like, I know you are all over all of them. So
if it's a French crime movie from Kino, I guarantee I'm on it somewhere.
And you always do a fantastic job. So thank you so much. Thank you for being here. If you want to get all of our episodes, listen to the other episodes of the Jack Hill series, go to our website, newworldpicturespodcast.com, and that's where it all lives. Thank you so much for listening to this episode, and we'll see you next time on the New World Pictures Podcast, a part of Someone's Favorite Productions Podcast Network. Bye, everybody.
Thank you for listening. To hear more shows from the Someone's Favorite Productions Podcast Network, please select the link in the description.
I know a good movie when I see one.